there's a part of the city you don't want to go to, period. There's a part of the city you avoid, whether it's Times Square or, you know, a borough that you haven't spent much time in. There is some, for some set of reasons, there is a place you don't want to go. And maybe it's an interesting thought about traveling itself as asking yourself to go to the place you don't want to go and then asking yourself why you feel discomfort there.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today, philosopher Chloe Cooper-Jones comes back on the show, this time to talk about the ethics of what is known as slum tourism and why a chapter I wrote on that topic for The Vagabond's Way wasn't included in the book at the recommendation of my editors. There were actually several short chapters that didn't quite make it into that book, but this one particularly intrigued me since the topic has such a strong connection to ethics, which Chloe, as an author and philosopher, is particularly qualified to comment on. You'll notice that she often brings in thinkers like Kant or Aristotle to analyze the ramifications of visiting disadvantaged communities as travelers. We talk about the inherent middle-class awkwardness in seeking out poorer parts of the world. We talk about the history of slum tourism, including the tourist vogue for visiting London's East End or New York's Chinatown in the 19th century, and how more recently the rise of the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s or movies like Slumdog Millionaire in the 2000s inspired slum tourism to places like South Africa and India. We talk about the tricky ethics of what has come to be known as voluntourism, that is, making short-term charity trips to distant communities in the hopes of helping them. In general, we talk about the symbolic versus substantial interest travelers take in places, and how genuine curiosity can at times blur into voyeurism, how earnest inquiry can flirt with titillation if we haven't properly examined our own intentions in new places. Our interview took place in a diner in Lawrence, Kansas, which Chloe was visiting from New York for a speaking event. You can hear ambient noise in the background as workers are setting up for lunch. We start by talking about how certain sections that I wrote for The Vagabond's Way were ultimately cut out of the book at the suggestion of my editors. Let's listen in. When I wrote my most recent book, The Vagabond's Way, there were several chapters that got cut for various reasons. And so this episode is about a chapter that got cut. I'm going to read it to you, and then we can speculate on maybe why it was cut and then talk about the topic that's covered in this particular chapter. The title is, "While You're Still at Home, Seek the Other Side of Town." And the epigraph is Dagobert D. Runes, A Book of Contemplation, 1957. He says, "People travel far away to places to watch in fascination the kind of people they ignore at home." In his 2011 book, The Most Beautiful Walk in the World, journalist John Baxter recounted the time a homeless man hurled an empty bottle against the side of his sightseeing bus as it drove through New York City's Skid Row. "We all flinched as the driver explained that some locals resented being turned into tourist attractions," he wrote. "Some years later, I took the same tour and jumped as an identical bottle shadowed just below my window. There's no business like show business." Baxter's sightseeing bus had been indulging in what is known as slum tourism, wherein tour companies offer middle-class travelers a brief journey through a city's poorer neighborhoods. Though the idea is to show visitors urban realities overlooked by standard tourism, it has a lot in common with the 19th century English pastime of slumming, wherein voyeuristic bourgeois men wandered the filthy back streets of London hoping to see aspects of lower class life, shanties, brawls, and prostitutes, not visible in their own neighborhoods. Fortunately, interacting with the poorer parts of a city need not be voyeuristic, and you don't have to travel to the favelas of Rome or the esquadras of Manila to encounter a less privileged way of living. Indeed, while you're still planning more far-flung journeys, you can journey out for a luncheonette meal or a church or a temple or a mosque service in the less affluent parts of your own hometown. Encountering the comparative adversity and resilience and vitality of these neighborhoods can prepare you to witness the complexities of distant communities, even as it deepens an awareness of your own." So can you guess why maybe they didn't want me to put that chapter in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about the conversations that happened around that decision to cut that. I mean, I wonder if the fear is that because that section is short, I mean, I know all the sections are short in the book, but that this is such a complex topic and such a nuanced one that maybe the fear was that brevity lent itself to possible misinterpretation of your aims. And that's a scary thing for a publisher, perhaps. I mean, what do you think? What were the conversations like around the decision to
You make a good point, because I think most all of the chapters that were cut because they dealt with issues that really couldn't be properly explained in one page.
Yeah.
And a one page is like 200 to 300 words, and it's just hard to not seem just completely cliched, I guess, in that level. I actually wrote down what my editor said. She said it felt forced and voyeuristic. So I think, too, that...
Why forced?
I think, basically, I was taking an example of slum tourism, and then I was flipping it and saying, well, why go on a slum tour on the other side of the world where you can just go to a poorer part of your own hometown? And this is something that we can think out loud about, but I think sometimes it's a cliche, and actually this topic is such that the discussions of this topic are so middle class that often we sort of have a middle class awkwardness with poor parts of the world that, you know, sometimes we'll go there voyeuristically, and sometimes we'll be so aghast that anyone would dream of going to those places, just look around, that we feel uncomfortable with that. But yeah, you know, there's that, you know, Baxter talks about how this bottle smashed against the bus, and then later, a few years later, another bottle smashed. Obviously, that guy was a plant. You know, the idea of awkwardness of the local people resenting the slum tour was something that they performed, you know.
Yeah, which is gross. Well, and strange, yeah. To turn it into a performance of that seems aimed at middle-class titillation and provocation more than anything. So any sort of veneer of any possible justification of like an educational purpose gets diminished by the truer aim, it seems, which is, to put on a good show for probably middle-class white people. And I think that's probably, there's like a lot of layers I feel like to unpack with the idea of, and this is true no matter where we're going as travelers, but there's a lot of layers to unpack about like why we want to see the things we want to see, what it means to go and stand in observance of something. And I think with, there's another issue, and I'm already sort of leaning maybe problematically into it, is who do we mean when we say we? Right now, like who are we talking, when I say like, when we travel, when we want to look at things, like who am I talking about? Like, is there a presumption that when I say, when we travel to these places, that I'm only talking about middle class to affluent, mostly white, mostly male, mostly, you know, able-bodied travelers? Like, if that's the we that we're only speaking to, that has its own issues.
That's something that applies to almost any conversation about travel.
Absolutely.
Because the we-ness of travel is always someone, you know, sort of a consumer or consumer adjacent person who has the leisure time to travel for pleasure, for leisure.
Right.
And so I think there's this sort of, in speaking universally about who the traveler is, it sometimes falls back on middle class folks, maybe upper middle class folks.
Right.
Going on vacations or extended journeys. So.
Absolutely. So that's, I think that's like issue number one, is like if we're, when we're talking about these sorts of issues, if we're only thinking about them in the context of a certain type of person, a certain type of traveler, that's, yeah, obviously it excludes, I mean, so many people are excluded from the language of travel writing by all the things that you're just saying. But I think one thing that's interesting about your chapter is that you're not talking about something that would require, by saying you can go explore all these aspects of one's own city, you're not necessarily saying you have to spend a lot of money and go across the world. You're saying there's a way of deepening your connection possibly to wherever it is that you live by not valuing the sort of shiniest prescribed paths or parts of your city. Or I think another way of thinking about it is no matter where you live, you sort of habitualize yourself to The neighborhoods you feel safest in, the places you feel most familiar in, your work routes, where your friends are, where your favorite restaurants and bars are. And travel does not require leaving your city or state or country, but it does require leaving your comfort zone or defamiliarizing yourself, putting yourself in a space that is going to challenge you. And that can happen a block or two away from where we live. And I think one thing that can be really valuable, and this is can apply to anyone regardless of where they may live, if I live in New York City, so what I am about to say could apply to anyone living in any borough, in any neighborhood, of any part in New York City, of any economic class, of any race, of any gender, anything, is there's a part of the city you don't want to go to. Period. There's a part of the city you avoid, whether it's Times Square or, a borough that you haven't spent much time in. There is for some set of reasons, there is a place you don't want to go. And maybe it's an interesting thought about traveling itself as asking yourself to go to the place you don't want to go and then asking yourself why you feel discomfort there or what you expect to see or what you might think you will hope to learn by going there, why you feel excluded from that place, or why you feel titillated by that place, which is what I think, this tour that you're reading about at the beginning of your chapter feels like that's what it's sort of about, like titillating, our curiosity about a life that feels different from ours. I think all of those feelings are valid. I'm kind of talking about provocation of the middle class or titillation of the middle class as an inherent negative, but I actually think any form of curiosity and any sort of exploration of your reactions to things in and of itself is valid. I think it just can't be the last step, right? Like if you're provoked by this person throwing a glass against your bus or something, that's an interesting thing to observe within oneself. But then I think the moral obligations come in, like, what do you do after that observation?
Yeah, so what's interesting, given the history of slum tourism, about the example in the canceled chapter from my book, is that the guy threw a bottle at the bus, sort of performing a kind of resentment that had been baked into the idea of slum tourism, which is a almost postmodern meta way of looking at this, because historically, slum tourism happened in London or New York. Mm. There were some infamous Chinatown tours where the people would come in and there would always be a knife fight.
Oh, yeah.
There would always be an opium den. And they would have restaurants with food that, in retrospect, wasn't very Chinese. And so it was almost like a different layer. It was sort of a fake. Authenticity has always been a problem with slum tourism, because people are looking for, air quotes, authenticity, which could be part of our conversation. I mean, travelers in general look for some sort of authenticity.
Yeah.
So it was staged. It was just like your average day in Chinatown in 1890 probably wasn't that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tour guides just made sure that they saw people that, like, if it was a real opium den, they probably wouldn't want random tourists wandering through. But somehow they were able to look on this. And so I guess the performance in this particular example where the bottle is hurled against a bus in New York City Skid Row is that it sort of foresees local resentment and then it performs local resentment.
Yeah.
And so I guess at the bottom of slum tourism, it's like if you go into another neighborhood, are you welcome there? Are you interfering with them? What are you seeing? Because I think one inspiration for writing this chapter was when I was traveling around America when I was 23, I wanted to go to Detroit and see what it was like, but mm-hmm. I didn't really know where to go and see the sort of the famously downtrodden part of Detroit. So I volunteered for a church ministry and I worked in a senior food pantry for a while. And it was really interesting. And one of the most memorable experience of that, I have my journal here. It says, we go a couple of blocks to the Enjoy Cafe on Jefferson, where the guy who was hosting us recommended good local color and soul food. And so we were in a poor neighborhood, but we were eating soul food at a place full of local people. And it occurred to me that at the very least in our own cities, we can go to a poor neighborhood and eat where the poorer people eat, right? And so part of my impetus for this chapter, which was since dropped from the book, was that there are ways to engage with your own neighborhood that doesn't necessarily involve voyeurism, but it could involve a church service or a restaurant or something like that. So mm-hmm. what do you make of that?
Well, I think it's just connected to the questions of why do you want to do that? Why does anyone want? And I think those questions can be answered really differently by different travelers. But, you know, it, sort of the, I think the core of what I really want to say about this is like, Aristotle, who I, you know, I'm a philosopher, I gotta bring in a little Aristotle, probably have to bring in a little Kant here to help guide me through some of these thoughts. But, you know, Aristotle says, to be human is to want to know, okay? That is just the basis of what Aristotle thinks humanity is. Our curiosity is not something we can eradicate, and it's not particularly helpful to feel shame or to put a lot of labels on curiosity itself. He believes it is the thing that, you know, our desire to know and our ability to accumulate knowledge and then use that to make decisions with reason and rationality, that's what separates us from any other living creature. It's what creates moral agency. So if someone says, I want to go into a neighborhood that is different from mine because I'm curious, to that I say, that is just the basis of our human brains, our human minds, and our humanity. I think that the second step then is to do, it sort of feels necessary to me to do the work to ask yourself then, why am I curious? What am I curious about? And am I using people's lives in a way that dehumanizes them to satiate my own curiosity, right? So, which is not what I think you're talking about at all when you're saying I want to go eat at restaurants that are outside of my normal sort of circle or something. I think that that is often what happens when people are going into neighborhoods that are unfamiliar to them, is that they are looking for a performance. They're looking for their narratives to be confirmed about what poverty is. They're looking in a way that could be exploitative. And the other, you know, here's, I'm gonna bring in Kant for a second, just to be that annoying person. You know, Aristotle says we gotta be curious. That's inextricable from human nature. But Kant says it's our moral imperative never to use other people as mere means to our own ends. So I think that the traveler is kind of, the ethical traveler is kind of, ought to be kind of constantly caught between those two truths, perhaps. It is fundamental to be curious, but you can't use other people as means to your ends. And so if you're moving into a neighborhood and you're usurping space, taking up space, using culture and leaving nothing behind, or using your observations to sort of further other people or separate your own sense of self from other people, like that all seems like using your curiosity and then taking it to a place of treating other people as means to your ends, meaning treating them as mere means to satiate one's curiosity. And that to me feels morally abhorrent. But I think that there are other ways to use the sort of travel to feel more connected to a broader human experience, to do the opposite of othering, to feel like knowledge allows for meaningful action that you can't simply get by avoiding these places. I think it's really important to ask yourself why you would avoid them. If there's a listener out there whose knee-jerk reaction is, oh, that's a horrible thing to do. Like that's we should observe that as well. Like, why would we avoid these places? So, you know, I think it's all a very tricky way. I think it's all long. I'm giving a really long answer to this because I think it's there's no simple thing that I feel like I could prescribe or say this is the right or wrong way to do this type of tourism. I think that it requires a tremendous amount of self-reflection and questioning about what you're what your presence in these spaces means. And that's something we don't always make space for when we're traveling. We probably ought to. Yeah.
As you were talking, I wrote down a couple of words. One is time, mm-hmm. because I think the more time you have to spend in a place,
yeah.
the better you'll be able to see it in an empathetic way. And the other thing was a group or individual. I think one problem about slum tourism is that it, as an industry, is that it puts people into buses and it shuffles them through. The bigger the group, the more of a presence they make in a place, the less interactive they probably are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and so I think, like everything, it just becomes really complicated. Just the ethical thing, because if you're in a bus with 50 people and you have 1 hour in a poor neighborhood, then it's going to be really hard to have a meaningful experience.
Yeah, that sounds like, I mean, it's hard to imagine a scenario like that that is anything other than exploitative gawking. It's not impossible that some one person of that 50 sees something that reframes their perspectives and leads them towards meaningful action in their communities. That's not impossible, but I think what you're saying is really important. The bigger the group and the less the time on one end of the spectrum, it's like, to me, the higher the likelihood of danger and exploitative behavior, and also this performative, this sort of demand or expectation that what those people want on the bus is performative, simulacrum of this space rather than any sort of real and meaningful engagement. Then it seems like maybe I'm cutting you off, and this is where you're going, is on the other end of the spectrum is individuality and lots of time, and that can also be exploitative or problematic, but maybe the odds are higher that it won't be. Is that where you're going?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the answer is always it depends. You know,
it depends. Yeah, it depends.
Depends on the individual and what they do with their time.
Yeah.
And you use the phrase narratives of poverty, which I think is always what we're up against, because when we go to a place that is other, well, I mean, there's narratives of, well, when you're in Paris, what narrative are you looking for? You know, are you going to put yourself in a narrative of Paris? Are you going to sit in a cafe because that's what you dreamed of? Or are you going to see the Eiffel Tower? Whereas I think oftentimes we go to poor neighborhoods knowing very little about them. And some of the critiques of slum tourism recently, like there was a boom in slum tourism after the movie Slumdog Millionaire mm-hmm. in India. And actually in the history of slum tourism, when South Africa apartheid was a big issue in the 1980s and 1990s, they started doing tours to these poorer parts of South Africa to sort of, because they wanted to capitalize on the curiosity of these poorer parts of South Africa.
Yeah.
And so, I think that those narrative, in both of those situations, apartheid was a headline, Slumdog Millionaire was an Oscar-winning movie, and suddenly it created a market for these narratives of poverty. And we can dig into this a little bit more. I think the point of my since-dropped chapter was, like, look for this in your own hometown before mm-hmm. you look for it on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And then just one more thing to point out about this is that oftentimes the people who were not comfortable with slum tourism in South Africa and India were middle-class South Africans and Indians who didn't want that part of their country to represent what tourists saw.
Yeah.
Which is understandable, but is also like, well, those poor places exist in your country, mm-hmm. so. I think Rio is another place where slum tourism, the favelas, people go to the favelas.
Yeah, so. Right. You know, it's interesting, this is sort of a swerve, but when we're talking about narratives about cities, or whenever you go to a city, what narrative you want to impose on that city, I think that in and of itself is, it on one end of this problem is somewhat unavoidable. You will have to go wherever you go, you go to Paris, you go to Prague, whatever, you go to New York City, you go to LA, like, you have in your mind a certain version of the experience or the story of that city that you want to have. If you have a limited amount of time there, you're going to seek out that narrative. And I think that's also something to kind of question. And then one thing that I have seen in New York a lot is sort of this opposite of the poverty narrative. But, you know, New York is a place where a lot of people move, and they sometimes move from, you know, like I did, from middle of America or from other cities, and they have this narrative that they'll put on New York that it's for their cultural extraction, right? Mm-hmm. So this is different than talking about going to the poorest areas of New York. This is like, they show up in New York and they're like, New York needs to give me its cultural goods. Like, I'm here to see all the museums and to see all the plays, and that's fine, that's great. You should do that, New York. I love that, it's one of the best reasons to go. But then I hear, you know, I hear all these people sort of complaining online, oh, the museum was so packed, or the play wasn't that good, and I had sushi, and it was just okay, and this was supposed to be a Michelin star restaurant, but as well, and New York sucks. I hate it here. This is a horrible place, because they didn't get the right cultural extraction that they were out of. Like, New York didn't roll out its red carpet for them in the way that they expected. I had to go to a bodega to get change for a 20, and how dare, you know. And I just, whenever I hear that sometimes from new transplants in their first year, just all these things that they did, the opera wasn't as good as it should have been. And I just think, like, people live here. Mm. Like, this is not a stage. This is not a set. Like, this is a real place. Like, people live their whole lives here. People like me raise their children here. Like, people invest in their neighborhoods. People pay their taxes to make schools better. Like, this is a real place. And I think anytime we're kind of putting a narrative, whether it be, you know, this idea of a poverty narrative, or of, well, Paris better give me the best. If I don't get the best baguette in Paris, I hate that place. Like, you can go the other direction. And I think in any of these circumstances, the question is, like, are you failing to see a place as whole? Are you failing to see a place as complex and multifaceted? And are you having experiences or responding to experiences that are really tied to a preconceived narrative, rather than allowing yourself to move through any space, from the opera to a favela, as open, vulnerable, non-judgmental, truly seeking knowledge and connection or understanding. And I think that these are just like two extremes of two mindsets that I think can happen literally wherever you're going and for whatever reason.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. And I wrote down on my notes, Yelp review. It's like the Yelp review approach to New York. Like, I was so disappointed because the lines were too long and the food wasn't as good as I thought it would be.
I hate that city. I'll never go back. I mean, people love to hate New York because all they did was go to the Empire State Building or go to the M&M store in Times Square, and it disappointed them. And I'm just like, this is not a place that's set up for your, it's not your playground. It's a real city where people live their lives. But of course, places like New York, places like Paris do set themselves up. And this is part of what you're talking about too with, and I saw this in my travels with dark tourism. There is a sort of, because there's an economic, there are economic gains to be made, they will narrativize, they will set up situations that are for people to come in, usurp, extract, and then leave. And that can be part of what, part of a self-awareness a city has about itself. New York certainly has that self-awareness about itself and sets up lots and lots and lots of experiences that are just meant for out-of-towners to come in and get out. And that's fine. I think it's sad when that's the full, that those experiences, those sort of highly curated experiences become the totality of someone's imagination about a place. That's when it's dehumanizing, I think, yeah.
When you were talking about New York, I was thinking about how there's been Harlem church tours for years now, mm-hmm. where like buses of Europeans will go and sit in the upper balcony
of a
church, and they're sort of looking for the gospel music, and they want to sort of pat themselves on the back for having gone to a part of Manhattan that most New Yorkers might not go to. But there's been complaints that oftentimes, you know, the German or Japanese people up in the balcony will be chatting with each other. They sort of see it as a performance for them, as opposed
Absolutely,
to being
yeah.
in a church that has its own rhythms and life and community.
Yeah.
And so I think part of the problem might be tied in to this big meta narrative is what do we know about a place, and what about that place makes us want to go there?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Slumdog Millionaire suddenly made the poorer parts of India interesting. And I was thinking, years ago, there was a tornado in Heston, Kansas, and I went there to volunteer for cleanup. And I got lost, and I was driving around, just sort of looking, and people started yelling at me, like, stop rubbernecking, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so I think in that situation, the people of Heston, Kansas were sick of people just going there to look at the destruction.
Yeah.
Because somehow there's this, it goes back to the question of why do we want to see what we want to see? I think a lot of people from Wichita, which I lived there at the time, just wanted to see the destruction. And I was literally there to volunteer, but I realized there was a lot of hostility because people were tired of people just driving around and seeing other people's misery as their entertainment.
Yeah.
And so I think this might tie into this in general, that there are gentle and ethical ways of going to poorer parts and of cities. And I think inevitably, if you take the time, you'll realize that there's sort of a normal rhythm to poor parts of the city. You know, you might hear about gun battles in the favelas, but if you go to the favelas, you'll just meet people living their lives. Mm-hmm. And so this might be tied into the motivations of why we go to a place. And
yeah,
I think maybe for the middle class traveler, it's like, oh, I'm going to be different. I'm going to go to a poor neighborhood. Well, why do you know about this poor neighborhood?
Right.
It's because of headlines that may or may not be representative of what's happening there.
Yeah. Do we want to pause for a second to let this ice?
We can pause for a second.
Ice machine. I have a response, but
this can be the special ambient noise episode.
Yes. I mean, so not to go back to Aristotle, but I think I have to go back to Aristotle.
Go back to Aristotle, please.
So Aristotle in the Poetics talks about. Talks about a lot of this actually, and all my sort of work in dark tourism and sort of thinking through what dark tourism sort of means philosophically really takes its start in what Aristotle says about.
Real quick, can you define dark tourism? Because some of my listeners might not realize there's a distinction between slum tourism, dark tourism.
Yes, I think, and we were talking about volunteerism. I think all of these things have a lot of nuance. I mean, dark tourism is sort of roughly understood as the desire to use your free time and your disposable income and your leisure time to specifically go to places that have experienced some sort of atrocity and then go immerse yourself in that atrocity. So it could be going to Rwanda and seeing the sort of ways in which the Rwandan genocide is now repackaged and sold to curious tourists. It can be going to Cambodia and going to Tol Sleng prison and in Phnom Penh and looking at the ways in which the Khmer Rouge genocide there is repackaged and resold as a tour for curious tourists. And a lot of the questions that I have about dark tourism goes back to, why do we want to do that with our leisure time? Why do some people want to spend their vacation and their restful time engaging in the wounds of places that are inevitably very different from their home? And then also, if we are the country repackaging those wounds, as New York City did for 9/11 memorials, how are we thinking about explaining our worst suffering and pain to other people? So how are we curating that? How are we setting it up? How are we educating? How are we framing it? And how are we making assumptions about what people want to see and what they're going to be drawn to, and how we might make some money off of that curiosity? So I look at dark tourism from the perspective of home and how we do that in the States, because there's plenty of that, and then also how I've seen it abroad. So part of my curiosity comes from Aristotle just saying in the Poetics that the Poetics is a response to Plato saying in the Republic that art should be banned and poets should be kicked out of the ideal republic. And Aristotle's part of his rebuttal is we are never going to get away from our curiosity about other representations, other experiences, and other narratives. And the way that we process the world is through seeing and looking and we want, and he has this great line where he says, and we want to do this even with the vilest subjects. He says, you want to look upon the vilest creature even in death and decay because you want to know. You don't want to experience, most of us don't want to experience death or suffering firsthand, but we still by nature need to know what it is. And that he thinks is just absolutely fundamental to being human. And so he gives the example of like, we all want to go, you know, back in the day, we all want to go to the theater and see Oedipus. Why on earth do we want to see Oedipus? That ends badly. Spoiler alert for anyone who's not seen Oedipus or read Oedipus. But I think rubbernecking is a perfect sort of more contemporary analog to this. We can't not look. And statistically, there are more accidents that happen around accidents than any other place, because there is something fundamental in our psychology that when we pass an accident, and maybe the more gruesome it is, the more we feel a need to look. Well, we might feel some shame around that. We might be like, oh, we're exploiting the suffering of other people by looking. Aristotle would say, maybe, but that's our brains. We have to make some sort of peace with that, that we, by our very nature, need to know, and part of the knowledge that we need to have is a knowledge of experiences we don't want to face in our normal life, which is why there's, you know, 14 Saw films and why there's horror as a genre. There's something that he thinks we're exercising when we're experiences those things, and he calls that catharsis. We're having a catharsis. We're purging ourselves of, he says specifically, pity and fear. And that can be really helpful. It's especially useful in a story, in a narrative that might be very tragic or something. That helps us purge pity and fear. It's much trickier when we're purging our pity and fear and feeling catharsis at the expense of other living humans, you know, or their history. That's when that idea of our curiosity that's very human can take a turn into some really pretty unethical territory. So that balance is a very tricky thing, and I think is really central to all of these questions here. But I think I keep harping on Aristotle's like call to know that part of humanness is curiosity, because you can't just get rid of that part of you that rubbernecks. You can't. But you can add on to that experience, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like there's rubbernecking and then there's inquiry.
Right.
And I think one conversation that we've had even, you know, during and after the pandemic is being aware of our communities and how they connect outside the bubble in which we live. You know,
yeah.
There are poor people in our own town who might be living a harder life than our own, and we should seek to have empathy for them. I guess the question is, how exactly do you go in to an unfamiliar place and seek to be, seek inquiry rather than rubbernecking? And I think that's why I mentioned this. The more we talk about this, the more I realize maybe this chapter was good not to include because it's just so big. But my example was like a church or a restaurant, because maybe it's because of what I experienced in Detroit, you know, that I sort of plugged myself into a community, a church that was doing, you know, had a senior kitchen, was doing some Habitat for Humanity style house building in Detroit. And then I went to this soul food cafe that I never would have gone to had it not been within walking distances where I was volunteering. And I guess that dovetails a little bit with volunteerism, which before the interview we were talking about a little bit, in that oftentimes overseas you go to an orphanage in Phnom Penh or in Nairobi, Kenya, and you want to feel, there's these competing narratives. You want to feel like you're giving back, but how can you give back in a week of volunteerism? And then these communities have very real needs, but is the best way to meet these needs through volunteerism?
Yeah.
I just gave you a whole bunch of examples, so I'll let you comment on what you want.
You know, it's strange. You know, I don't know that much about volunteerism, and I've never done it myself. I know there's a lot of different ways that people do that. I know within the states, there's you can go volunteer to be basically a, you know, a field hand on people's farms, and that can be kind of a part of volunteerism or sort of experience tourism. I don't know if you're going to feel the same sort of ligature between what you're saying and what I'm about to say that I have is... I think that, I feel like at the core of so many of these questions is, are you there to extract a resource? I mean, that becomes the sort of central question of so much of gentrification, exploitation of neighborhood, like all this sort of is like, is your primary aim to extract a resource? And maybe that resource is your own fulfillment and your own expansion or something, or your own curiosity. And the thing that I keep coming back to in my mind is during the pandemic in New York City, I was teaching at a nursing college. So all my students were New York City nurses working on the front lines with no PPE and dying at a very fast rate, getting very sick, dealing with the first wave of COVID and all the misinformation and the trauma that everyone was experiencing. And New York City started doing this thing at 7 p.m. where everybody would bang pots and pans. Do you know about this? Did you hear about this at all?
I think I heard about it in Italy or Spain or something.
Oh, maybe they were doing it in a lot of places. Yeah, where like everyone would open their windows and we'd all bang pots and pans. And I did not do this because of what my nurses said to me, but it would happen in the neighborhood. And like the intention behind that was to say, we're thinking of our, you know, frontline workers. We are with you. We haven't forgotten you. Solidarity. Yeah. We're all here. We love you. We're supporting you. And we don't have to do what you have to do. We get to stay home and stay safe. We get to be, as privileged as possible in the pandemic while you are, quite literally at the frontier of the most sort of deadly unknown thing that has happened in many people's lives. But here we are, you know, banging our pots and pans, and my nursing students would say, we hate this. A lot of them really hated it. They understood the intention and they appreciated the sort of gesture of solidarity. But their question was, how quickly will you forget about us? So when we get through a hard moment, how quickly will you forget about us? Will you care about our working conditions when it's not relevant to you immediately? Will we fade from your consciousness as soon as we're not dominating the news? And their suspicion was yes. And therefore this action feels meaningless or worse, condescending. And I think that that's sort of a question with any sort of volunteerism too, is it's nice to come in and with good intentions and put some houses together or make some meals for people. Like all of that feels probably generated by mostly benevolent impulses. But I wonder how many people in those communities are saying, but how quickly will you forget about us? Once you've extracted the experience you want to have or you feel good about yourself, you can pat yourself on the back, will we then be gone for your consciousness? And I wonder if in a lot of cases the answer is yes, and they know, and people in those communities know that, and therefore feel maybe even further dehumanized or condescended to rather than really met on multiple levels. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a way, a solution to this, because actually I was thinking there's parallels like 9/11 responders, like firemen and policemen were heroes for a solid month. Everybody wanted to celebrate firemen and policemen after 9/11. And often, you know, after the Vietnam War, there was sort of some bad attitudes that were being communicated, at least in the popular imagination, against soldiers. And so now there's sort of the thank you for your service thing where you go up to the soldier in the airport and say thank you for your service. Yeah, and I suspect soldiers get a little sick of that too. And so when we bring the best of our intentions and we want to make a connection to a poor neighborhood or to someone who served in the military or to anything that is outside of our sphere, this is actually a big travel question in general. What does it mean to go to another place, come back and be away from that place, and how does it reside in our hearts? What are we giving back to it?
Oh, can I say something? This is really interesting to me. I hope this isn't too much of a swerve, but I think it's really related to what you're saying. Is there's this really interesting study, which I can't remember the name of, but it was on the ways in which people who were very active about social justice issues online, on social media, were inversely less likely to actually do anything. And part of what this study was trying to hypothesize was, and I think this is totally true, is every person has limited resources to give, right? So if you are really passionate about any sort of issue, justice or any sort of betterment of any community at all, or what you see as moral action in the world, you are still, regardless of the level of your passion and commitment, you are still one person with with a limited resource, with exhaustion and other responsibilities. So if we think of our energy, the energy that we have to spend, or the resources that we have to give to a cause we care about, right, or to the betterment of somebody outside, if we think of that as like a dollar amount that we have to, you know, we have 100 units of energy to give to this cause. This study was theorizing that tweeting about it actually took up some units of that energy, and then you sort of reflecting, oh, I did my good thing for the day. And I think that's the same thing with like the pots and pans. You go, oh, I did my good thing for the day, and I've spent my units, and oh, I feel great, I'm a good person. Or I went up to the soldier and in the airport and said, why don't you board ahead of me? You know, you go ahead and thank you for your service, and where did you serve, son, or all these sorts of things. It's like, oh, I've done my good thing. And it's not that I think those are net zero actions. I actually think those are positive actions. But if you spend your limited reserves on those actions and then you're spent, then they become not very meaningful, right? So if you say, every time you see someone in fatigues, you go, thank you for your service, but you don't learn anything about how awful our healthcare system treats veterans, how much PTSD exists because we still don't do enough to support people that are coming back from really traumatic experiences overseas fighting wars. Like, if you don't care about any of that, or if you're not allocating your time and energy to those more meaningful things, like, are we really getting any closer to our principles or our goals? I think the same thing can be said about any sort of engagement with communities that might need help or might benefit from our engagement. If we say like, well, I went in and served some soup, I'm good. Like, that's not a net zero action. That's a good thing to do. Serving soup is fine. But if that spends up all of your charitable thoughts, actions, or commitments, you know, if you just on Christmas go to the soup kitchen and you go, I'm good for the year, feel great. Like, maybe that's something to challenge in oneself and to ask oneself, like, where do I want to spend those 100 units? Is there a better way of doing it? And am I somehow alleviating my moral responsibility with platitudes? Yeah.
Well, this is a good question, because the big picture issue is it better to do something or to do nothing? Is it better to stay in your bubble and not risk, you know, being offensive or being self-congratulatory? Or is it better to try and maybe fail a little bit on experiencing other realities and neighborhoods, or reaching out to a soldier in a superficial way? And what I was thinking, a specific incident I was thinking about, is that after Hurricane Katrina, I had sort of a connection to New Orleans. I had friends there, so I was visiting, and just a friend and I were driving through the Lower Ninth Ward, again, a disastrous situation like the tornado in Kansas, and talking to people and stuff, and there were some volunteers there who were doing good work. I forget, Common Ground or something, but we talked to some of the volunteers, and they were really, really critical of people coming in to the to the Ninth Ward just to see it or to sort of superficially come. But their self-righteousness sort of took me aback because they were the same thing. Like, did they even know what the Lower Ninth Ward was before they came to volunteer? And so they were actually living there and doing good work. But it felt like their self-narrative was a big part of why they were there. You know, that I'm not sure how quantifiable the help they were doing was. I'm sure it was probably more helpful than our just random curiosity and striking up people. And I know that there were also Blue Line tours, that which were even more problematic because they were air-conditioned buses and you were just looking out the window at the Lower Ninth Ward.
Yeah.
But it occurred to me that even these volunteers were tourists in their own way. That they this narrative of disaster and poverty had brought them to this place because they wanted to help, but they also wanted a story to tell about themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the thing that's so annoying about this question. I'm glad we're talking about it. I think it's the kind of thing we could talk about for many, many, many hours, many years. And not solve it, because you're really getting at such a great example of doing something is better than nothing, but doing something is not everything. And so it's like there's just so many gradients within that experience. And I'm kind of, as you were telling that, I'm visualizing like all these gradients. There's like the people that live there, the people that are invested in the community, who will stay in the community, who will see the community through things way after Katrina. There's the people that are gonna just swoop in, build a few things, tell a good story, you know, go home and go, oh, you know what I did? I'm the good guy. I'm in the white hat or whatever. I'm the knight in the white hat. And feel good about themselves, but yet we're helpful. And it's better than not. Then there's people that are curious, which I think, again, sometimes seeing things, really going and being present can help us conceptualize. And I think there's a lot of people who could very easily just go like, oh yeah, I heard about Katrina, I'm not gonna look at it, I'm not gonna think about it, I'm gonna absent any responsibility to understand what's happened there, right? So that's not good. So, but then there's the people on the air-conditioned bus just going, you know, gawking. There's all these levels to it, and there's no way of saying that one of these levels is completely wrong or completely right. And I think that's why this question is so fascinating and so philosophical, because it requires us, rather than, you know, we can't possibly end this podcast with an answer, but we can lean into the mess of it and say, like, part of our human responsibility is to be as aware as possible of the mess of this question and our own place in it and our own complicity in it, which is maybe very unsatisfying to the listeners.
Well, I mean, the more we talk, the more I realize why my editors wanted me to take this chapter out, because it's a ragged-edged thing that is not really prescriptive.
Yeah.
Because you have, like, I guess this is the ethical question of having knowledge of a place outside of your bubble, be it just a tourist experience in Siberia or Namibia, does that knowledge, what does that knowledge do for you and for the communities you experienced? If, obviously, tourism in general has an economic impact, I'm sure that some slum tours give money into that slum neighborhood, but is that enough? Like, is that, what, again, it's the doing something versus doing nothing question. And I think every level of that Katrina tour, there's the tour bus people who maybe their ticket on the Blue Line tour is given back to some sort of rebuilding effort.
Yeah, totally.
And the individual, like myself and my friends, we were going with inquiry and we were talking with people individually. And then there's the volunteers too, who, to my mind, sort of had a self-congratulatory narrative, but were certainly spending
more
time there than I was.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, maybe as we sort of come full circle in this, how do we encourage people, listeners, to seek inquiry and, yeah, what?
I think there's just like two tools, right? Which is asking questions of oneself. Why am I here? You know, you keep saying inquiry, and I think that that's such a crucial word here. To sort of, round out this conversation is, and I think the thing is self-inquiry, right? Like, why am I here? What am I hoping to see? What are the stories I'm gonna tell later about why I was here and what I saw? Are those stories in some ways reducing or deflating the complexity of why I'm here and what I've seen? And then I think the other tool is listening. So if that inquiry goes outward, like to the people you're interacting with, are you doing more, way more listening than telling? Are you doing way more true, like open, non-judgmental and non-prescriptive engagement? Like, is that ratio should be really high. And then when you leave that space, do those people see, or those spaces cease to exist in your mind? Because if so, that's probably a problem. So I think, like, yeah, there's no thing we can do other than ask these questions, be open to their answers, do a lot of listening, set aside as many preconceived notions as possible. These are all like really hard and vague things to do, but I actually think it's like kind of the only way forward.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Chloe Cooper Jones's book Easy Beauty, as well as my own book The Vagabond's Way, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.